Good morning, this is Tracy Hales Bass, right on Four Corners. Today I'm talking to Joseph Badal about his mystery thrillers. Good morning, Joseph. How are you today?
I'm fine, Tracy. Thank you for having me on the show.
I have to say I enjoyed the two books that I just finished of yours, the Cycle of Violence series so far, with The Motive and Obsessed.
Well, thank you.
Yes, I love the characters. They became very real to me. Dr. Curtis and his wife, and even the project that she was working on.
Oh, Save the Kids, yeah.
Save the Kids. Yeah. From what I read about how these two books came to be, there was actually an organization, something like that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was at a dinner party, and a doctor in Albuquerque came up and said, "I got to tell you a story." And I have to tell you that every time somebody says that to me, I shudder because, you know, people come up all the time and say, "Well, you need to write a story about this," and usually it's not very interesting.
Right.
Well, in this case, it was so interesting that I was about to leave the party until my wife grabbed me by the ear and said, "You can't do that. That's rude." I wanted to get home and get on the computer and start writing, but they told me this story about getting a call from a Honolulu detective who told him that his sister had just committed suicide by jumping off her balcony in a high rise in Honolulu. And so, you know, he went over there to settle her affairs, and they wouldn't release her body, and they found drugs in her system, and then he had a memorial service for her, and nobody from the law firm she'd worked for showed up at the memorial service, and all this, you know, he's telling me these details, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this thing is going to make a great book.
Right.
And it was so good, and thank you for your comments about Matt and Renee, but I liked the characters so much that that book became a second book, and I've already finished the third book in the series, which is called Justice, and that will be out probably early next year.
Oh, great. I can't wait to read it because I can tell we need more.
Well, thank you. One of the things I did with this series, and actually I now call the series The Curtis Chronicles, is that I kept the antagonist alive through the entire series.
Right.
And usually, you know, with mysteries and thrillers, you kill off the bad guy, and then you start with another bad guy if it's a series.
Right.
And you keep the protagonist going. But in this case, I thought Lonnie Jackson was such a good bad guy that I thought, I'm going to keep this guy around for three books.
He is a good bad guy. He's very complex, very smart, and he has ways of really confusing the issue.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you caught that. So.
Yeah, yeah, I liked it. I liked him. I liked to hate him, I guess, is what you say.
Yeah, well, you know, that really is well said, because that's what you want the reader to feel. You want the reader to hate the bad guy, but be fascinated enough by him that they want to keep reading about him.
That's right. Yes, frustrating in his complexity, for sure.
Yeah.
But this is not the only set of books you have. As a matter of fact, there's quite a few.
Yeah, I've now had 13 books published.
Congratulations.
A six-book series called The Danforth Saga, and that one is literally started out with the actual kidnapping of our 2.5-year-old son.
Oh.
When I was stationed in Greece with the U.S. Army, and again, loved the character so much, and I just carried that through. So now there's six books in that series, and I'm about to start on the seventh. I also have a series called The Lassiter Martinez Case Files,
mm-hmm.
which stars two female detectives with the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office.
Oh.
And so there's two books so far in that series, and the third one will be out next year as well. And then I have three standalone books that what I try and do is between books in a series, I try and write a standalone, just kind of to clean my literary palate, if you will.
Right. I was actually going to ask that. How do you juggle all these different characters and situations and keep them all straight?
Well, Tracy, I have to tell you that I'm not sure it's any great intellectual leap, but it's all about passion. I wouldn't do this probably if I wasn't so passionate about writing and telling these stories. And mm-hmm. It's with 13 books out and working on two right now. Sometimes I'll find myself in the editing process naming a character from a previous book. So I've got to, that's why I do a lot of editing.
Yes, I can only imagine. And your dreams must be crazy.
Have you been paying attention to my dreams?
I just can imagine.
That's not, you don't want my dreams.
I don't think so, actually. One thing, though, that you have said previously is that your protagonists are everyday heroes.
Yeah.
That find themselves in not everyday situations.
Yeah, I guess the underlying theme in all of my books is the triumph of good over evil. Mm-hmm. And my characters, my protagonists, are not superheroes.
Right.
You know, there's a very successful author who wrote a book about a guy who jumped out of an airplane over the Vatican holding four corners of a tarpaulin. Well, I can tell you that that's not possible.
Right.
And that kind of stuff is not what my characters do. My characters are literally based on real, everyday people who are confronted with an obstacle, and they have a choice. Mm-hmm. They can run, or they can confront the obstacle. And I'd like to think that my characters react the way an everyday person, man or woman, would react if a family member was in danger, or if there was a terrorist that was threatening their country.
Right.
But again, they're not leaping tall buildings in a single bound or dodging bullets.
They're reluctant heroes.
Yeah. Nobody wants to be in, unless they're nuts, nobody wants to be in any of the situations that I put my characters in.
Right.
They'd like to get up in the morning and go have a coffee and go to work and see their friends and have dinner with their family at night and so forth. Well, unfortunately, life intrudes on everyday, events intrude on everyday life that can force people to have to take action that they would never dream about having to take.
Right. And I like that Matt and Renee say, well, we've been victimized, we're not going to be victimized anymore.
Yeah, that's kind of a sub-theme that it crops up in several of my books, where somebody, as you astutely put it, somebody's in a reluctant hero, and they, it's fight or flight, and they typically flee, and until they reach a point of where they've had enough. And in fact, I've got a book that I've finished, and it's in the hands of my publisher now, and it's really about a guy who has never confronted his problems. He has always run away from his problems or let somebody else fight his battles for them up to a point. And he reaches that point and he says, I'm not going to be a victim anymore. And again, that's an everyday person response.
Right. Do you have something you can read for us a little bit to give the listeners a little taste of your voice?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Since my most recent release is Obsessed, which is the second in the Curtis Chronicles.
Yes.
I thought maybe what I should do is read from the first couple pages of The Motive, which is, again, the first in the Curtis Chronicles.
Great.
And that might give the listeners a chance to kind of get a feeling for my voice.
Good.
A slight tremor snaked through Matt Curtis, as though he'd been hit by an errant chill. He looked at his blood-smeared, gloved hands and, for a beat, wondered about it. He let the moment pass and announced, "Let's close her up." Matt removed the spreaders that had kept the incision open and used a syringe to inject sterile water into the woman's open hip wound. Then he took the surgical thread from the nurse. About to go to work on the wound, he felt suddenly unsettled. Another tremor hit, but this time it was more severe. It seemed to emanate from within. His hands shook. Sweat instantly drenched his body. He gasped for breath. And then, like a shimmering hologram, his sister Susan's image filled his vision. Her body appeared translucent. A brilliant aura radiated from her head. Matt looked over at John Ransom, the orthopedic surgeon assisting him. Ransom stared back, eyebrows raised in question. Matt's gaze shifted to the two surgical nurses. They, like Ransom, seemed frozen in place. Concern and wonder etched their faces. "You okay?" Ransom asked. Matt grabbed the edge of the stainless steel table and pressed his eyes shut. For a few seconds, his brain seemed foggy. He felt faint, disoriented. Then the feeling stopped and he left him only slightly lightheaded. He opened his eyes and searched the room for Susan. Matt squeezed his eyes shut again, ordered himself to get a grip, and looked again at Ransom. "Yeah, I'm fine," he lied. He used an arm to shield his eyes from the intense glare of the overhead lamp. A smoky haze seemed to fill the room, and for a moment, Matt thought the walls undulated. His vision blurred, as though a filter had been placed over his eyes. He forced himself to appear calm. "John, finish up," he said. He wheeled around and left the operating room. He stripped off his cap, mask, bloodied surgical gown, gloves, and booties, and washed his arms up to his biceps at the first sink outside the University of New Mexico's orthopedic surgical suite. He looked up at the wall clock over the sink. Had to squint to make out the time. 3:15 in the morning. Nothing new in that. Since cancer took his wife Allison a decade ago, he'd poured every ounce of energy into his patients with demonic intensity. He and Allison had tried to have children, but after 3 miscarriages, she couldn't bear the loss anymore. Allison, Susan, and Matt's mother had been enough for Matt, but not for Allison. So they'd adopted 2 little boys. Allison was the perfect mother, and Matt the perfect provider. After Allison died, Matt didn't know how to fill the holes in his son's hearts. 2 years later, they were both off to college. Now they were adults and strangers. He felt as though he'd just run a marathon, tired, weak, used up. Sure, it was the middle of the night. He'd been on his feet since 7 a.m. the previous day, one operation after another. Too few surgeons, too many patients. But he'd worked that kind of schedule for years. "I'm getting old," he thought. 51, and I feel 70. Matt shuffled to the doctor's locker room, the picture of Susan imprinted on his mind's eye. There was no one other than his 2 sons, who meant as much to him as his sister did. Despite the 4-year difference in their ages, he and Susan had been like twins their entire lives. They finished one another's sentences, felt the other's pain. But what the hell was that all about back in the operating room? He stripped off his clothes and dumped them in a laundry basket, then shuffled to a shower stall. He adjusted the water flow to pulse, then placed his 2 palms against the shower wall, bowed his head, and groaned as the water pounded his skin and cascaded over him. His muscles ached. His backbone felt permanently bent. Matt repeated his daily ritual. He ran a finger down the scar in his lower back, over his spine, and silently thanked God that he could stand it all. The doctors had told him he might never walk again after his car crash in high school. He reached higher and touched one of the 3 puckered scars in his upper back. He no longer had the flexibility to reach the other 2, and wondered how much luck one person was due in a lifetime. 3 bullets in the back over 30 years ago, compliments of a Serb soldier. After 10 minutes, Matt reluctantly turned off the water. He grabbed a towel from a shelf, rubbed it roughly over his skin, and wrapped it around his waist. Then he snatched another towel and draped it over his shoulders. He walked back to the locker room and eased onto a wooden bench. Bent over, elbows on his thighs, face in his hands, he released a low moan and again wondered what had happened in the operating room. It had been a momentary, eerie sensation. Couldn't have lasted more than a few seconds. Maybe I'd better schedule a physical. Then another chill hit him as though an Arctic wind had invaded the locker room. Matt turned to see who had opened the door, but there was no one. Matt's skin prickled. The hair on his arm stood at attention. He felt a presence, certain someone had entered the room. "Damn," he whispered through gritted teeth as he looked around again. No one. He stood and shucked the towels, opened his locker, and reached for his street clothes. Even when he finished dressing, the chill he'd felt hadn't completely gone away. Probably just need a good night's sleep, he thought. Then he made a mental note to call Susan. So
yes.
That's the first chapter.
And that definitely captures the reader's attention.
Well, that's the idea.
It did. It worked. I couldn't put them down.
Oh, and then, great.
Now I'm just eager for the next one.
Well, thank you.
So you're quite the prolific writer. You've got all kinds of things, but you also have so many things in your past. When did you start writing?
Well, it's not quite responsive to your question, but this is something I always wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't really start until 1999. I was working full-time, and I actually the first two books I wrote, The Pythagorean Solution it's not Terracell wasn't the second one I wrote, but it was the second in the Danforth saga.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those came out while I was still working full time.
Wow.
And the reason this Terracell came out before Evil Deeds in the Danforth saga was because the publisher wanted to get it out in time for the Olympic Games in Athens, because the book takes place in Athens.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had two of them published between 2003 and 2007, and then the other 11 have been published since then.
Wow. And are you still working full-time?
Oh, no.
You're writing full-time.
Yeah, I retired at the end of 2007, and I've been writing full-time since then.
Great. But you, a Vietnam War vet and a New Mexico State representative...
Right.
So you've been a busy guy.
Yeah, I was looking at my resume preparation for our talk today,
mm-hmm.
and I said, "Oh my goodness, I must be really old because I've done a lot of things." But yeah, you know, and it's great that I've had all those experiences, because they lend themselves a lot to plot lines in my books.
Right.
To character development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in high school, I told my dad I wanted to be a writer, and he said to me, "Dummy, you have no life experiences to write about that anybody would want to read about."
Right.
And that was pretty rough, but he was pretty correct.
Yeah, I've heard that, yes.
So I fixed him. I went and joined the Army, but but I got a lot of, you know, anybody that has lived any amount of time has had experiences, and of course the more travel you do, and being in places like Vietnam and Greece, you wind up with experiences you wouldn't have normally, and those experiences will often form the foundation for stories.
So did you have to force yourself to spend time in Hawaii for the motive?
Yes, I did. I suffered through that.
Oh, I can imagine.
I try in every case, except where you can imagine. You know, the Nostradamus secret, there are scenes in Iran and Syria. Well, obviously, I had to go to the internet to get authentic locations and so forth. But generally, I always try and go to a location where the book is going to take place. So, for instance, Sins of the Fathers, Death Ship, a lot of the action there took place in Turkey and Italy, and so I went there. I'm one of the next book in the Danforth saga will probably take place in Italy, and I just got back from a trip to Italy and did a lot of research for that book.
Oh, neat. Somebody's got to do it, I guess, right?
It's a dirty job.
Really?
And I'll tell you, it's not always all fun and games either, because in order to generate authenticity in a book, sometimes you just got to get off the beaten path and go to places that, for instance, I go to places without my wife because she is not comfortable going to those places, and I don't want to put her in that kind of danger anyways.
So. Right. But you've got to do it to see what it's really like.
Yeah.
Well, the books come across very real. And I know the second one of that series, Obsessed, was set pretty much right in our own backyard in the Albuquerque area.
That's right. Most of it takes place. Well, it starts out in Brazil, but
right.
Most of it takes place in the East Mountain area, east of the Sandia Mountains.
Right. And you can tell you captured that very well, knew that area.
Yeah.
So, Tony Hillerman, you won a couple of awards from that conference, right?
Well, there's a Tony Hillerman Prize Fiction Book of the Year, and two of my books have been awarded that prize, which is just a tremendous honor, because Tony Hillerman was the first successful published writer that took me by the hand and helped me.
Oh,
and
exciting.
He read my first manuscript and was extremely gracious in his feedback and honest in his feedback.
Yeah, good.
One of the things that I've learned, you know, I always thought that all you had to do was tell a good story. And when I started writing novels, I had no experience. I was a finance major. What did I know about writing novels? So I discovered that there's a huge amount of technical aspects of writing that I was not familiar with. And so my first manuscript for the Pythagorean Solution, I thought it was a terrific story, but my editor wound up looking like he'd opened a vein and bleeding over the all over the manuscript. And, you know, he used a red pen, and it was horrifying, the mistakes I had made. And I learned more from that editor than I probably learned from anyone or any one thing that I have been involved with since I started writing. And I learned, you know, you got to have a good story. And a great story can sometimes carry bad writing. But that's not what I aspire to do. I want a great story, but I also want my writing to be as good as it possibly can be.
I agree, and you've achieved both.
Well, thank you.
Especially
Well, you're terrific.
Oh, well, hey, I love my job.
Thank you.
But, yeah, thrillers, mysteries, they especially, you have to pay a lot of attention to the details and the technique and the way things are proceeding.
That's right.
And then, let's see, New Mexico, Arizona Book Awards?
Right. They have named a couple of my books the Best Fiction Mystery Thriller Category Books of the Year, and Military Writers Society has awarded 3 gold medals to 3 of my books, and I just heard from the International Book Awards, where one of my books is a finalist. Again, I had one last year that was a finalist, and again, one of my books was rated one of the top 5 books submitted this year. So,
congratulations!
Yeah, well, it's a kick. I mean, to have worked in banking and finance all my life, and then wind up doing what I really always wanted to do, and getting good positive feedback is terrific.
Yeah, well, you work hard for it. So what? How do you think that your career as a financier informed your writing or your writing process?
Well, I think that's a great question. I've never had that question before. I first of all, I've written I wrote one book that's a financial thriller, and that's Shell Game. And so the story is based all about the financial world. And so obviously there I drew on a lot of my personal experiences. But I think another thing that I got out of the banking and finance career, my business career in general, that has helped my writing and informed my writing is that when you write whether a business letter or a paper or a proposal, it's got to be economically written.
Right.
It can't be wordy.
Right.
It's got to be factual. And I think I learned, because I learned to write professionally in that finance career and learned those techniques of writing, I think that I've been able to carry those techniques over to the fiction world.
I think in a thriller where there's action, that's really important. You have to be concise, but you have to say enough to carry it.
Well, that's correct. And what you've got to do is you can't, and think about this for a minute, how difficult this can be, and you cannot allow the reader to stop. Because
right.
if the reader stops reading, they may not continue again.
Right.
Whether it's in that book or reading another one of your books. And so, and today's reader also does not want lots and lots of flowery detail. I always jokingly tell when I speak to writers groups, I said, unless you're writing a book for meteorologists, don't spend a lot of time on the weather.
Right.
And unless you're writing a book for interior decorators, nobody really cares much about the color of the wallpaper unless there's blood on it.
Right.
So, and, you know, the publishing industry today is so different from what it was. You know, you go back not too many decades ago, and writers got paid by the word.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
Why fiction or any writing was so flowery and wordy.
That's right.
Well, that's not the case anymore.
But yet, as far as the weather goes, your characters in Obsessed were driving through snowstorms.
Yep.
And the action was happening in the snow, and we knew what the weather was because it was included with that. So that's the way to do it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think basically what the snowstorm was doing, I personified the snowstorm. Basically,
right.
The snowstorm was a character in the book.
Yes, definitely.
But it wasn't, the book wasn't about the snowstorm. And,
right.
You know, one of my favorite authors is James Lee Burke, and he's the only guy I know that can get away with huge tracks in his books about the weather and the scenery and so forth. He's almost poetic in the way he does it, but that's not the way I write. So.
Right. Yet you capture the scenery. Like you said,
yeah.
The weather was definitely a character involved in that and affecting the other characters.
That's right.
Well, we are just about out of time.
Well, this has gone fast.
Hasn't it? Is there
well,
anything else you want to add?
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your support. And yeah, if anybody's interested in reading my books, they can go on Amazon. My name is spelled Badal, Joseph Badal, and my website is josephbadalbook.com, josephbadalbooks.com. And I think I would encourage people to either go to their local bookstore and order a copy or get on Amazon and buy one.
Great. That's right. They can see your whole repertoire there.
Yes, ma'am.
Good enough. All righty. Well, I appreciate the time you've taken, and I appreciate your writing, and I look forward to the next one.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on.
That was Joseph Badal talking with me today about his many books, his mystery thrillers. This is Tracy Hales-Vass, right on Four Corners, KSJE 90.9 FM, Farmington, New Mexico. You can reach me at writeon@sanjuancollege.edu. Thank you for listening.